Dr. Paul, welcome to Against the Wind, Doctors in Science Under Fire. Today's interview, Dr. Ryan Cole, pathologist with a background in immunology and virology. He just demystifies everything COVID. Talks about how there's thousands of genomes, meaning variants. You cannot do gene manipulation to get ahead of something that mutates that quickly. And we talk in depth about spike protein, what it's actually doing, and then an eloquent explanation of your immune system. It will help you understand once and for all why you don't need, you don't want a COVID jab at all, ever. We even touch on RSV. Yep, we do. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. Today I wanted to talk about where do we get our power? Now, most of my medical career, I lived in ego. It was like I was all powerful, I was all knowing, and even though I remember in medical school they said, don't be paternalistic, I think I was a lot. That can also be a very scary place to be, because if you're making all the decisions and you're responsible for everything, and God knows, I don't know that much. In fact, you should know that. The more you know, the more you don't know. You know, you've heard, seek and you will find, ask and it will be given. Power, real power, comes from surrendering personal control and accepting guidance. I had the blessing of losing my license. Like, bam, overnight I get the phone call, you've been emergently suspended. Some of you know that story back in 2020. Talk about putting you in a position where you better understand you're powerless and you better start seeking some counsel. And I was blessed to get a lot of amazing coaching. You know, I see a lot of people who act entitled. I deserve this. You owe me this. And to me, it feels like when you are coming from that place, because I've been there myself, it destroys faith, it destroys love, and it puts you right into ego. I want to share a little story of back when I was in Africa, 2009. I took most of my kids to Zimbabwe where I grew up, and I showed them the village I grew up in. We had a wonderful party celebration at a village home where my adopted kids grew up. And my bio kids, who'd never been out of the country, were absolutely amazed at the love and the joy that came from within of all their peers they were playing with. African kids who owned literally nothing but the shirt on their back that probably they borrowed. And yet they had such joy. You don't get joy and love and that fullness within your soul from possessions, from power and earthly things. You get that from connecting with love. So I say let's practice daily to be grateful for everything we have, the loved ones we have in our lives, and then stay humble, stay willing, stay anticipating, because there is a message and a direction that I know I'm certainly being called to, and my guess is you are too. When you stay humble and open to direction, life becomes an adventure. And that becomes your power. Welcome, Dr. Ryan Cole. It is such an honor and privilege to have you on Against the Wind.
It's great to be here with you, Dr. Thomas. It was great to meet you at the FLCCC meeting, finally in person. I've followed a lot of your work and your life story, so it's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. For those of you watching who don't know Dr. Ryan Cole, he gave what should have been the keynote talk at the FLCC conference recently held in Florida. It was just so robust in the science. So we're gonna get into that. But for people to get to know you a little bit, I know that you are the CEO and medical director of Cole Diagnostics. Since it carries your name, I'm guessing you founded that company. You have an incredible background, board certified pathologist, and I'm going to ask you later what that is for people who don't really understand what a pathologist does. You trained at Mayo Clinic. The unique thing I didn't know until I was reading your bio, you've worked as a doctor in emergency medicine, family medicine, dermatology. That gives you such a deeper understanding, in my opinion, of, you know, as a pathologist now, you can kind of relate to the clinical presentation. And so your lab, I mean, you are a full service pathology lab, molecular testing, microbiology, blood testing, cytology. You look at biopsies. You've handled over 175,000 COVID tests and diagnosed over 500,000 patients using mostly the microscope in your career. You've spoken nationally and internationally on science, the truth about the pandemic, which we're going to dig into, on the medical freedom area. And then kind of interesting, just to make you a real human being, I can't wait to come out to your organic farm where you have lambs and cattle and ducks, chickens, 250 fruit trees. You're also, as a hobby, I think it's a hobby, but it sounds like you're pretty good at it. You build furniture out of wood, unique pieces, guitars, wooden boats, functional wood art, and you're the proud father of six daughters. Wow.
It's all, you got it. You nailed it. That is my background in a nutshell there. And, you know, I like to throw that stuff in at the end because really, I think one of the most important things in life is balance. I do life and death by day through the microscope here. What I do is very serious. But at the end of the day, just finding that greater connection to all things in life and, you know, creating, working with the earth, trying to raise good kids in this world, it all tries to balance out.
How would you explain what you do and for people to really understand it?
I like to explain the pathologist is the most important doctor that you will never meet that you always hope is right. So our job, you know, some of the older generation remembers Quincy and autopsy and things like that. And that's certainly part of our training. And some of us, you know, still do autopsies, others don't. My day job more than anything is sitting here at the microscope. Since say you go to your doctor, you'll get a biopsy and those biopsies go through a special process and then they get in turned into a microscopic slide. And then that biopsy, you know, we can do all sorts of studies on these tissues and make a diagnosis. Is it this? Isn't it that? If it is this, how bad is it? Is it an infection? What type of infection? Do we need to do additional studies? So the pathologist is the quality control of all of medicine. So as you mentioned, you know, all day long, it's a CSI with cells and or blood and or microbiology specimens or genetic workups. So we do a complex array trying to get for you, the practicing clinician, a diagnosis so you know best how to go forward treating your patient.
Very well put. I imagine when COVID hit us in early 2020, right? As a pathologist, prior to that, walk me through what happened for you in your career as relates to, you know, COVID hitting us.
Sure. So in addition to all those things that, you know, I've done in my career, when I started medical school, I did MD, PhD work in immunology and virology. The lab I helped set up, it was a biosafety level 3 laboratory. And we actually, and it was kind of me as the med student and the PhD student setting up that lab. And we showed exactly how HIV was continuously reinfected into cells through a certain type of cell called the dendritic cell. So I had a pretty deep background in immunology and virology many, many years ago. And when this came along, I studied SARS-CoV-1, I studied MERS. So those were in my wheelhouse. And I understood very well this family of viruses. And when I heard the inklings coming out of Asia that, oh gosh, we have another SARS virus, I'm like, oh, great. And was I overly worried? You know, I had concern like everybody did at the beginning. We were going into the unknown. And I dove right into early treatment. I mean, anything in medicine, you know, we're going to treat first if we can. So that was top of mind. And I reached out and spoke with a lot of colleagues on what things work, what didn't. I was big on the hydroxychloroquine bandwagon very, very early in 2020. And I was face to face, you know, once we started testing with thousands of sick patients. So I prophylaxed and took me well over, I see, 2020, 21. Yeah, I mean, took me almost 2 years to get COVID personally.
Wow. Yeah.
And then when I had it, I treated, I was, you know, I had a bad cold for 3 days and was fine. But the journey for me was the anxiety of patients. So again, I was a clinician for many years, doing many of those areas of medicine you mentioned. I had lots of patients face to face, very anxious. What do I do? What do I do? Basic for me, well, gosh, what's your vitamin D level? That's going to tell me your immune status. Are you eating too much sugar? Do you have underlying conditions? Are you going to move your body, or are you going to sit on a couch afraid, eating tons of things that are going to make your immune system weaker? So I took the opportunity early on to educate, and literally thousands upon thousands, we set up a testing station out in the parking lot. So, you know, we weren't inside a building, and, you know, kept people in their cars and would bring them in one by one, et cetera. So we did a lot of testing. So education was the beginning of it. Then the concern for me came when they said, we're going to have a warp speed vaccine. Mm. And all of my alarm bells went off right away. Again, I understand virology. This family of viruses will always has and always will mutate ahead of our vaccinal efforts. And so when they said they were going to do that, I knew something was gravely wrong in the scientific thinking. And then, you know, in retrospect, we can connect the bureaucratic dots of who was working with whom and why. But at the end of the day, to try to use a vaccine as the solution for what we've gone through was a horrible idea. It still is. And going forward, always will be with a coronavirus. There's a reason. So again, I worked with HIV in the 90s. And 40 years later, the reason that Fauci doesn't have a vaccine for HIV is because HIV also has a spike protein, its own family of spike, different from this one. But that spike always mutates. So there's a reason 40 years later, his holy grail of an HIV vaccine has been an abject failure. Same thing with coronaviruses. 40 years from now, a vaccine against a coronavirus will be an abject failure.
Hmm. You showed a slide at the conference that showed, I think it was over 2,700 SARS-CoV-2 genomes just since 2019. When I say genomes, does that mean those mutations? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So in laboratory medicine, we can do very specific sequencing, and you can see, okay, a nucleotide is different here, which makes a different protein. So now that spike bends this way and that way and this way, or the membrane is slightly different, et cetera, et cetera. So one little point mutation, or two or three or 10 or 20 mutations, all of a sudden, you're dealing with a different beast. So at any given moment, I mean, early on, there's a website I like called nextstrain.org. And it basically gives the family tree of this particular outbreak. But there are tens of thousands of mutations and variants. Are all of them viable? No. Are some more severe than others? Sure. But at the end of the day, When you're treating a virus, when you get infected, you don't just have one virus in you. One cell, it may replicate with a certain mutation. You literally have a swarm of viruses. So when someone's infected, they may have 100 or 200 little variants or more of SARS-CoV-2 in their body at that moment. So if you get infected with Omicron, which is dominant now, Omicron, you know, B4.6, is the more dominant one now, or BQQ, some of the others that are going up, you're going to have 100 variants of that one virus, or 100.
Wow, I was not aware of that.
Yeah. And so your body is going to try to fight it off. The immune system, the human body, is an amazing thing if you take care of it. But if you don't do the right things, then some of those different variants maybe become the stronger variant eventually. And now you're infectious and may give a more infectious variant to another, especially when we give a shot that selects narrowly for only one or two variants, when literally your body has hundreds. So yes, you are correct. There are not only hundreds any given individual, but in the world, literally tens of thousands of variants of this virus now.
Wow. That's why you said earlier, there's no way you can vaccinate your way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you could explain to us, why is vaccinating a mistake with this kind of a virus?
Well, number one, it mutates very quickly and it replicates very quickly. So when you give an injection, and these aren't true vaccines. These are a gene-based injection. You know, a true vaccine is a killed protein or a killed whole organism with an irritating agent called an adjuvant that makes your body have an immune response and then try to form antibodies and then hopefully T-cell immunity against the infection. To vaccinate against this, you're going to have a very narrow library of those antibodies. Now, they can bind and in some cases neutralize a small percentage of those viruses. But the problem is the Wuhan variant that's still in these shots in this gene is extinct. It went extinct over a year and a half ago. Now, the bivalent shots, the BA4 and the BA5 that are in the shots, those are almost extinct as well because we're onto subvariants of those. So now we're vaccinating with an antibody, well, with the gene that makes your cell make a spike protein, which is completely abnormal to turn your body into the machinery, a factory for making a foreign protein, because now your cells become an enemy to your immune system when they make this foreign protein. So that's a bad idea. So this whole construct was a bad idea, but even a worse idea, and this is interesting if you go back just a few years back and look at the history of dengue virus in the Philippines, and they created a vaccine called Dengavaxia, and they gave the shot, and then the next season, when the next variant of dengue came along, more children were hospitalized, more children died. And that's the same thing with this. You're making an antibody for what is generally present in the environment, but with that drift and that mutation away from what it originally was, now your antibodies, instead of being your friend and helping maybe bind and neutralize the virus, now become your enemy, because they will now bind, but they can't neutralize that virus. And so they'll kind of grab onto it, and then this little end of the antibody that's supposed to like freeze and then say, hey, I'm yummy, gobble me up and clear me out. Instead, now it binds to a receptor on your garbage truck cells, your macrophages, and then it gulfs the virus in, and now it hijacks the machinery of your cells. Now your body, your own immune cells, which should be fighting off the virus, now become a replication factory for the virus. So now you've gone one step further down a bad pathway of more inflammation. So when you vaccinate against a family of viruses like this, and there's several others we'll never be able to vaccinate against because they will mutate, and then eventually, this is called antibody-dependent enhancement. Your body, it's immune imprinting. So we've literally put blinders on the horse of your immune system. Now your horse can only see that original variant and this bivalent variant, but it can't see future variants. And now your body wants to only make immunity to these old, I like to call them legacy variants because they're gone. So you're literally pre-priming your body to have the inability to fight future variants of coronaviruses, not just SARS-CoV-2, but SARS-CoV-3, 4, 5, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now. And now you may have an antibody floating around in your body that, instead of being a friend, can cause you more harm.
Hmm. And I recall early experiments with, I think it was the original SARS or MERS, where they, in animal studies, when they would re-expose those animals, most of them or all of them would die.
Yeah, in the ferret study. So ferrets are used because their lungs are very similar to human lungs. So in the ferret studies, I mean, I've heard people say they all died. No, a lot of those papers, unfortunately, as we've seen the internet get scrubbed of truth and information and science, it was about 20% of ferrets in that SARS-CoV-1 trial. But interestingly, in the mouse trial, the mice that didn't get vaccinated versus those that did, and that was a traditional vaccine. This just shows that the spike protein in and of itself is dangerous. The animals that got the shot, 100% of those mice had lung pathology. They had kill off of very important types of air sac cells, and they also had a really interesting hyper allergic infiltrate in the lungs in every single one of those animals in that trial. So that's why they never brought a human trial to market with that SARS-CoV-1 17, 18 years ago. And then when MERS came along, similar studies were done, and MERS was obviously more deadly than either of these, but same thing happened. When you tried to vaccinate against it, it mutated ahead. And then when the animals were exposed to this new wild type virus, their immune system again became an enemy to self. And so we have a long history of this. So to do what we did societally is like slapping history in the face and saying, oh, history doesn't matter. No, it does matter. And science, you know, as much as science changes, most great discoveries are accidental and happen in leaps and bounds. But slow science, we should look at history and realize, let's not repeat stupid mistakes.
Yep. Yeah. Amen to that. We're going to come back to spike protein, but I'm just curious on your thoughts about RSV, because obviously we're hearing in the news, our hospitals are, quote, at capacity, kids filling up hospitals. As a pediatrician, RSV is just a seasonal thing that we have every winter. I always used to think, boy, if they could make a vaccine for RSV, that would sure help. Now, in light of what they just did with COVID, what are your thoughts about this race for an RSV vaccine?
It goes back to the basic principle in virology. Viruses always mutate. Now, does RSV mutate at the same rate as coronaviruses? No, it doesn't. But many years ago, RSV vaccines enhanced disease in children, and we had a history of RSV vaccines failing similarly to what these have done. RSV is a high risk for little tiny children because, you know, their air sacs, or I mean, their windpipe is, you know, this big. But for every fraction bigger it gets, the airflow rate, I did aeronautical engineering and physics at the Air Force Academy a lifetime ago too. So that's why they're at risk. It's the diameter of the windpipe and the basic small wind branches that go into the lungs. The RSV problem we have right now is because we have given too many shots that have suppressed the immune system of humanity. Now, people who normally wouldn't get other viruses, and we'll get into this with the spike harms, they're a petri dish. We have a population petri dish of people carrying viruses with which they would normally just keep them in check and just clear them out. We have a highly infective population carrying too many viruses now. Same thing in the kiddos that did get the COVID shots. Now, because of suppression of their immune system, they're not able to fight off other common viruses. So this emergency was induced by bad science. RSV will always mutate. And going forward, these big companies say, oh gosh, you know, we can make a lipid nanoparticle plus a gene sequence against RSV now. No, you can't. This platform in and of itself is dangerous, and I know we can get into that in a little bit. Any lipid nanoparticle gene sequence shot needs to be stopped here and now. There's no long-term safety for these. These products have never successfully come to market before. And that's what's very important is there's a reason we didn't have mRNA gene therapy, vaccine therapy prior to this, because everything Moderna had tried up until now failed. Now, Bourla, in an interview with the Washington Post, CEO of Pfizer, said to his scientists, hey, why are we doing mRNA? We've only been working on this for, you know, 2 years and change. We don't have a long track record. So he even knew as CEO. So what forces behind that forced them into this, I don't know. So for RSV, they think they're going to, you know, declare an emergency. So now they can emergency authorize this lipid nanoparticle gene sequence RSV vaccine, and it's only going to lead to more disaster scientifically. RSV, like you mentioned, it's treatable. And what's fascinating, it's a single-stranded RNA virus like SARS-CoV-2 is. Fascinatingly, it has a little zipper that helps replicate itself called an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. Guess what? If you get enough zinc into the cell and bind that, you slow the replication or stop the replication. Some of the early treatment drugs that shall not be named, you know, that were very successful in COVID are very successful in any single-stranded RNA virus, be it influenza, be it RSV, be it coronaviruses, et cetera, et cetera. So what we need to be looking at is early treatments. RSV is a problem right now, yes. Most people do fine. And again, I think scaremongering and fear within a society seems to be where the big money is made for government agencies and pharmaceutical companies, but not in the best interest in the health and the wellness of an individual.
Yeah. So my own data, which was just a general pediatric population, but I have, you know, enough families who don't vaccinate at all that I could compare all health outcomes of vaccinated compared to unvaccinated. And lo and behold, just about anything we look at is more prevalent in the highly vaccinated. You made a comment about we have all these people going around just petri dishes of various infections or carrying different loads of different viruses. And I think you either stated or implied, but I just want it to be clarified. Is it the vaccinated or the unvaccinated who are a greater threat to, let's say, the vulnerable population? You know, they always talk about the immunocompromised, the very elderly, people with underlying conditions. Who's a bigger threat to these people, those who are highly vaccinated or those who are not?
Those who are highly vaccinated are a higher threat because, again, it goes to that blinders on a horse, this immune imprinting. For example, we societally came out with this quadrivalent flu shot in northern Italy, grown in dog kidney cells right before the pandemic hit. Fascinatingly, they had higher death rates and did worse in those who got the shots. There is a protein sequence on one of those portions of flu on that shot that overlaps with SARS-CoV-2, and that causes that enhancement reaction and worse disease. So those who are highly vaccinated, their immune system is narrowed, you know, not just to SARS-CoV-2, but all these other shots. If you look at T cell immunity, T cells are far more important. Everybody hears about antibodies. I say antibody schmantibodies. Antibodies are a surrogate marker that we look at, and you know, it may give an indication of a reaction, but far more important are these little marines of your immune system, your T cells. You and I have 30 billion circulating in our body right now as we sit here and talk. Everybody listening does. And they each have a job, and they're there to immediately attack and ward off invaders into the body. When we give too many shots of too many types, again, we narrow the skill set of those fighters, of those marines. Now, an infection may come into the body, and the Marines that had broad skills to fight off this, they're like, wait, I can only do this kind of fighting. And the others are, I can only do this kind of fighting. And the others are like, I'm getting drunk and going back to the barracks and not fighting at all. And so what we do, and we think, you know, we're doing society a favor with shot after shot after shot after shot. We are not. Because your body only has so much immune memory or breadth of immunologic memory in reserve. And so if you start to compartmentalize that memory into a very focused, narrow area, you're doing it at the expense of breadth of being able to non-specifically fight off lots of things. And so the immune system, again, is an amazing thing until we mess it up. And there are other things, you know, societally. So yes, the vaccinated are higher risk. The other thing too is those with low vitamin D levels, those with suppressed immune systems are at higher risk because their immune system doesn't function properly. And vitamin D isn't a vitamin, it's a pro-hormone that's so critical. It's a conductor of the symphony of our immune system if you have your vitamin D in normal level. So everybody in North America north of the 35th parallel right now is vitamin D deficient if you're not supplementing, period. If your vitamin D is low, then your immune system is like the mosh pit at a punk rock concert, just banging together, but not really knowing how to talk to each other. So yeah, the vaccinated are the basically the shedders, the super carriers, because of the narrowness and the non-breadth of their immunity.
Yeah, I've been a big proponent of vitamin D, and I was glad to have you explain that. I think, and I'm curious what you think of this, you know, the normal range, they talk about 30 to 100. I think it's
nanograms per milliliter.
Uh-huh. Nanograms per milliliter. Thank you. And but the cancer protection, for example, lots and lots of studies that go back a decade or two, most of that protection was when you were at 50 to 80 range.
Correct.
So what range would you consider optimal for you and your loved ones?
So I usually keep myself between that range, 50 to 80. So at about 55 nanograms per milliliter, your vitamin D receptors are saturated. But when you get an insult, an infection, a cold, a flu, whatever, your body quickly uses and consumes that vitamin D and burns through it. It's like fuel in a car tank. You need to constantly be refilling that vitamin D level. So I may go into an infection and my level is 65 or 70, but in 2 or 3 days, it may be down to 30 because it's being consumed very quickly. There are 17 cancers related to low vitamin D levels, 17. And so to keep your vitamin D levels up, I mean, it's fascinating as I have many colleagues around the country and some are oncologists. And when they have a new cancer diagnosis, I ask them or they volunteer, they just basically say, and their vitamin D was low, and their vitamin D was low, and their vitamin D was low. And so I optimally 55 is really the bottom of where you want to be. Now, some people will get frustrated. There are vitamin D receptor mutations. Some people, it's hard for them to get up to normal levels. That's a set percentage of the population. But really, most of us can achieve that 50 to 80 range.
Yeah. I test vitamin D all the time. I've found that unsupplemented, people are in the teens or single digits.
Yeah.
It's incredible how low people's vitamin D can be. And it can take for teens and adults at least 5,000 IUs a day. I don't know what you think about giving it with K2, but I feel like maybe that helps usher the calcium into the bone.
Yeah, that's the important part. I'm glad you bring that up, is two things. So vitamin D, if you get your levels up towards the higher end, it will help it will cause calcium to be released from the bones into circulation. Two things, magnesium, the majority of our population is magnesium deficient. Mm-hmm. So magnesium will mobilize vitamin D from your fat stores into circulation where you want it and need it, but it will also push calcium back to the bone. So osteoporotic women, most of them aren't calcium deficient. They're magnesium deficient. If they had normal magnesium, their bones would be strong because the magnesium helps in that balance to push calcium back to where it belongs in the bones. And vitamin K2, the MK7 form, is very, very important. You can literally reverse plaquing of the coronary arteries with adequate amounts of vitamin K2. So again, so many basic, simple things we can do in medicine instead of depending on pills and complex procedures. If we optimize this amazing gift of a human body with things that are widely available to us and very inexpensive, we wouldn't need so much of these giant systems healthcare. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if I go to an emergency room with a bone sticking out of my leg, I'm glad there's an emergency room. But at the same time, there are things we can do for our overall health and physiology that we should really focus on. And I'm glad that you've done that for your patients. You're a rarity in medicine, that a doctor that will focus on that very important thing.
Well, and sounds like you are as well. You touched on the T cell part of the immunity, and I just want to highlight that for our viewers. We've been brainwashed to thinking that if you have high antibodies, that means you're protected. And I mean, even doctors, right? Our peers seem to have lost that basic science of immunology, that it's really that robust T cell immunity or innate immunity prevents the infection from taking hold to begin with.
Correct.
The antibodies is sort of the secondary defense. And so if you have sky high antibodies, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, is it?
No, in fact, you know, you want your antibodies in a certain range, and people say, oh gosh, my levels are higher, higher, higher. Well, actually, when you have excess antibodies, that can trigger autoimmune reactions too. So again, antibodies are triggered when you get infected, this adaptive immune response, this memory B cells waking back up and starting to crank out antibodies. You know, that takes days, if not weeks, sometimes during an infection. But to your point, that innate immune system, which consists of those certain types of T cells, macrophages that circulate monocytes, and then a type of cell in your skin called a dendritic cell and in your lymph nodes, that 1-2-3 punch, that innate, those are your front line. You know, those are you want them to attack right away when something insults the body. That's what you want to have robust. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Let's pivot to spike protein. This was the topic of your talk that was so powerful. The whole idea behind this quote shot or vaccine, which I agree with you, it's not a vaccine. It's immune. I can't call it therapy. It's manipulation of something.
Gene manipulation.
Yeah. It's insanity. But the whole idea that they presented to us initially, and you know, I'm not an immunologist like you are in background, was, oh, okay, so we're gonna inject it. It's just gonna stay in the muscle. They told us, we knew very quickly that didn't happen. And then you're gonna make antibodies against the spike protein and you'll be able to just get rid of future SARS-CoV-2. But what it's actually doing is somehow inserting into our own cells and creating the ability of our cells to make spike protein, which is the exact thing that's the toxin.
Correct. Yeah. So we've really done a strange scientific procedure here that it doesn't make sense to me. The spike protein itself, in Early on, even in a congressional hearing, we knew about the antibody-dependent enhancement we talked about. That was talked about in a congressional hearing. In the journal Nature in 2020, I want to say it was June, or may have been April. I'd have to look up the article. They knew this was a problem, too. Early on, the Salk Institute looked at the spike protein and said, oh, we have a problem. This is causing inflammation of the lining of the blood vessels. Oh, guess what else? It's destroying the mitochondria, which is every cell in your body has mitochondria. It's the little factory for energy for every cell in your body. And so that Salk Institute paper by Lay that came out early on said, the spike protein in and of itself, absent the virus, is causing problems. And then there were countless other papers that have come out. Dr. Hageman in the European Journal of Immunology showed that the cells in your body that make the spike protein are now a target of your immune system to attack and destroy. So to have a cell making the spike now makes your own cell an enemy to the body. There was a really good paper by, I'm going to blank on the author, Castillo maybe, showing how many overlaps there are between the spike protein and other human proteins. And again, don't quote me on the author on that one. I may have to go back, look at that. But so many of these proteins that are our own cell proteins are very similar to the spike protein. This is a problem because that's how you start the cascade and the trigger into autoimmune attacks on your own thyroid cells, on your own joints, on your own organs. So that was a problem. The other problem with the spike protein is it causes clotting. The spike protein, so early on SARS-CoV-2 in 2020, before any shots at all, COVID was a clotting disease. Because that spike protein on the virus, which you know would break off and circulate as well, would trigger a bunch of different mechanisms that made clots form. So we're literally putting a protein gene into your cells. Your cells are making a protein that induces clotting. So why are we hearing about sudden deaths? Why are we hearing about deep vein thromboses and then saddle emboli and pulmonary emboli and people dying suddenly? Well, clotting is one of those main mechanisms as well. Here's the other problem. The spike protein is tiny enough that it can cross the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier in the human body is sacred. It's a special barrier that keeps things out of your neurons and keeps your neurons functioning. But when that barrier is breached and something gets in there that doesn't belong there, now you get an inflammatory response. Lots of cytokines, lots of other inflammatory cells. And you know, certainly we heard about brain fog with infection, but gosh, what about the neurologic harms after the shot? That spike will go everywhere. And this lipid nanoparticle, the virus is, you know, reasonably big. I mean, it's small as far as viruses go. But generally, my colleague, Dr. Urso, I like his analogy. He says the virus needs a door to get through. This lipid nanoparticle and gene, they just need a crack under the door. So this lipid plus this gene go everywhere. Now they can make any cell in your body make the spike protein, including your brain, including your neurons. And this spike will also induce antibodies against your own myelin. You hear a lot of people with neuropathy and stinging and burning in their arms and their fingers and their legs and their toes. That's because it's forming antibodies against your own nerves and nerve sheath and nerve lining. And it forms an antibody against your platelets called platelet factor number 4. This spike protein is toxic to the human body in so many countless ways. I mean, I could send you a link of 300, 400, 500 different papers just showing the toxicity of this little protein that we have made the human body make. And I mean, that's why the shots should have started or stopped from day one, because we knew the spike was toxic. It's still toxic. The more we keep giving to people and encouraging people to cumulatively get a dose of a toxin, that's insane. I wouldn't sit at the dinner table and say to a kid, hey, gosh, you know, there's just a little arsenic in tonight's mashed potatoes. And then the next night say, you know, tonight there's just a little more arsenic in your mashed potatoes. And the next, you know, 3 months later, there's just a little. No one would do that. And it's the same thing with these shots. Why are we slow poisoning a population with something that we know is toxic?
Yeah. So the mechanism that makes total sense to me is how you pointed out the spike can be manufactured by almost any tissue in our body now, once you're vaccinated. And I think, is it true that vaccines are causing a massive dose of spike compared to maybe getting the natural illness?
Yeah, that's a great point. So in a natural infection, going back to what we've talked about, your innate immune system says, here's an invader, activates all your immune system, says, fight the virus, clear it out. So you may be sick and replicating virus. If we look at early studies, you're replicating virus for a handful of days to maybe a week and change, and then it's gone. So in a natural infection, if the immune system is proper and you're taking care of your body, the virus is gone in days. With a spike protein, and there were studies from Dr. Ogata at Harvard that showed the spike was still in circulation after the injections for at least a month. Dr. Roltgen at Stanford in the journal Cell showed for at least 2 months, especially with the Moderna and the Pfizer, because they have a substitute nucleotide called a pseudouridine instead of our natural uridine, it doesn't break down. And so in these studies, they showed that for at least 2 months, and they stopped their study to publish, so probably longer than 2 months, the body is still making spike protein. Little pulses, constant, that sequence, that mRNA is still there. Our body normally breaks down mRNA in minutes to hours or sometimes a day. Because of this substitution and the synthetic nature of this sequence, it's persisting in the body, and your body's like, huh, I guess here's the message. I'm supposed to make more spike, constantly. That's not good.
Yeah. I've heard of, vaccine manufacturers are very sneaky. They will do their safety studies for a week, maybe a month.
Right.
Very rarely do they do really long-term studies. And it feels to me like I've read and heard of problems developing if they don't happen right away, a few months out. Does that make any sense as a...
So this is again, like you mentioned, it's just a game they play. See, safe and effective, no problem, nothing to see here. These are not the droids you're looking for. But really, at the end of the day, with this spike protein, especially in this new type of injection technology, with old vaccines, yeah, the most acute reactions would occur in the first couple of weeks, certainly. And most of those studies, obviously, they never even studied them against placebo. Same thing here with these shots. They crossed the placebo group over very quickly in the early trials. So now you don't get a signal of harm. With this spike protein persisting and circulating, Journal of Immunology, Dr. Bonsall showed the spike protein circulating for at least 4 months. Knowing that the spike is toxic, can go anywhere in the body, an adverse reaction 4 months out is not uncommon. And if we look actually at some of the statistical data done by certain statisticians here in the States, as well as in Europe, independently, they found that that increased excess death signal was at 5 months. So this chronic inflammation of your blood vessels, this irritation of the blood vessels, the spike getting into heart tissues and causing myo and pericarditis in young patients, getting into the brain, causing clotting and strokes, et cetera. These signals where they say, well, nobody died in the first couple of days, or only that set percentage did. And the majority of deaths do occur, acute anaphylactically to components of the shot in the first 2 days. But there's still a signal going a couple of weeks out. But what's fascinating is these excess death signals are literally persisting for 4 or 5 months. And the manufacturers and our agencies will say, well, it was too far out from the shot. It can't cause that. We've never given a gene-based shot to humanity before. Of course it can cause that. We haven't studied these long-term before, except for in animals where they all failed. And then we did know in Moderna's trials with mRNA, it didn't work. It's scientific hubris to think we have done something good. And it is an absolute overreach to think that this can't be a persistent harm for a long time. Now, I don't want to panic people. Fortunately, a lot of people are fine. Thank heavens. I think the manufacturing was poor because it was ramped up quickly. I have a lot of hypotheses as to why a lot of people are fine and a lot of people aren't. There were hot lots. People got more damage from certain lots of shots than others. Due to concentrations of mRNA, et cetera. But I'm grateful a lot of people are okay for now. But what happens in the future with another coronavirus with those who are pre-primed with the wrong antibodies? I don't know.
Yeah, it's certainly a concern. I'm real curious about something. You're a pathologist. You're looking under the microscope. What are you seeing that's unique or different about this particular issue of spike protein, the vaccine, the illness itself?
Yeah. So early on, obviously, I saw the clotting signal. So the microclotting, you know, looking at a lot of biopsies and you see these little clots and little vessels. So that was an early signal. Next signal was, after the shot rollout, skin bumps, there are certain viruses, molluscum contagiosum, shingles, et cetera. All of a sudden, I started seeing a much higher rate of those. But the unusual part was I was seeing molluscum in old people, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80. And don't worry, I'm counting myself in that group. So, but I started seeing that. I'm like, gosh, we never see molluscum in old people. This doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But then I'm like, oh no, we have immune system dysregulation. So that was another signal. I'm like, well, what else do these innate immune cells do? They keep cancer in check. And I saw a signal and I'm like, oh dear. And the signal was an increase in certain women's health types of cancer. Also, a very important component of our T cells fighting off a certain cancer is melanoma. I diagnose a lot of melanoma. That's my subspecialty of expertise. And all of a sudden, I saw really aggressive melanomas. And every time they would roll out the shot to a younger group, I would see melanomas in younger patients. And immediately, again, it all goes back to, it is altering our innate immune response. There was a really good paper by Dr. Fossa out of the Netherlands looking at Pfizer, and he said, we have a very concerning signal that the innate immune system is being altered by these shots. So that cancer signal was the next thing. And now I got lambasted in the national media for telling the truth. Science advances by observation. If you see something, say something is what you hear in the airport every time you travel. Well, right. Medicine, far more importantly, because it's also life and death. If you see something, say something. And so I put it out there to my colleagues. Well, everywhere I've traveled, not just stateside, but internationally, I just got back from Norway and Sweden last week, been in France, I've been in England, I've been in Brazil, a lot of places with COVID experts in each of their respective nations, oncologists, surgical oncologists, radiologists come to me. I am seeing astounding numbers of cancers in young patients that I have never seen in my 30, 40 years of practice. And what's brand new in society? The rollout of a gene-based injection for the which we don't know the long-term side effects. So the databases are going to be clear in a couple of years. The data reporting is always behind, sadly. But doctors are seeing it. They're observing it now as well. I've had several pathology colleagues come out and say, yeah, gosh, we're seeing it too. I can't say anything. I'm in a university. I'll lose my job, et cetera. I'm like, well, humanity is more important than your job. You need to say something. So is it everybody? No. Do I want to panic everybody? No. But here's another problem. You know, I talked about all those mechanisms earlier of the spike. All of those can contribute to cancer pathways. But here's the other problem, the impurity of these shots. There's something called microRNAs. And so you think you're getting a gene-based shot and this mRNA is pure. Well, in the European Medicine Agency, they showed it was only about 50% pure. That means there are short sequences, tiny little mRNA fragments that may code for who knows what. Not all of them code, but some can code for a tinier protein and a mid-sized protein and a misfolded protein, and your cells go, I don't know what to do with that. And there's plenty of scientific literature over many years showing that microRNAs are also a contributor to cancer pathways. Your mitochondria need energy in your cell. And if those mitochondria are destroyed, well, now you don't have the ability to fight off cancers. Microclotting, cancer likes to grow in an oxygen low environment. The microclotting can induce that. There's so many things. So that's another big concern, another reason to stop these shots. The signal is off the charts, the potential human harm. And the sad thing is, you know, people who were stable in their cancers for 3, 4, 5, 10 years, all of a sudden their cancer has woken back up and it's a wildfire. And I've seen cancer in patients that are in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and they go from diagnosis to stage 4 disease in like weeks to a couple months. And that's unheard of in medicine. Does it happen on rare occasions? You bet. But we have this perfect storm of at least a dozen mechanisms. I have paper on about 20 mechanisms that this spike can cause that can trigger these cancer pathways. Mm. Again, I don't want to alarm everybody, but watch your health. If something is different, don't be afraid to go in. Now, is part of that signal the fact that some people didn't go to the hospital? Sure, that's part of the signal. But the acceleration rate of cancers, that's not because, you know, clinics were closed around the world for whatever number of months. because those patients still would have had just what we call indolent or just slow progressing cancers. When I talk to oncologists, they say, gosh, you know, we've been able to manage this type of cancer or this type or this type for many years. You know, the patient's going to have 2 years or 5 or 10 years. We know how to manage it. But when they see that type of cancer all of a sudden behaving in a super aggressive, fast manner, they know something's different as well.
Yeah. So doctors, our peers, are saying, if you're high risk, you are the ones who should be at the front of the line to get the next COVID vaccine. And they're, you know, if you have heart disease, if you have cancer, if you have a suppressed immune system, it seems like those would be the last people you would want to give this shot to.
I like to quote Mark Twain in some of my talks. The man who does not read has no advantage over the man who cannot read. I don't know what my colleagues are reading, but it sure appears they're not reading. They have a confirmation bias going into safe and effective. They've been brainwashed into safe and effective when there is zero evidence that it's safe and zero evidence that it's effective, especially since it's covering essentially extinct variants of this virus. So at this point, it's all risk, zero benefit. So these individuals that have these underlying conditions, well, number one, try to address the underlying conditions, certainly. But number two, there are ways to optimize immune health, even in these individuals. And if you can't, there are early treatments that will inhibit the replication of virus. So these individuals should all have on hand early treatment. So if they do get sick, you can stop the virus from replicating. We need to, I mean, autoimmune patients, going back to our vitamin D conversation, what's the one commonality in most autoimmune conditions? Those patients are vitamin D deficient. To try to get them and to optimize the immune system, you know, if people do believe in the antibody theory, you know, many antibodies exist, but the more normal your vitamin D level is, the more robust your antibody response is as well. So these individuals with heart disease, with autoimmune disease, with immune suppression from cancer therapy, the last thing in the world you want to introduce into their body is a toxin for variants of a virus that are not in circulation anymore. And the next trivalent, quadrivalent, whatever, you know, COVID gene-based shot they come out with, the virus will already be mutated ahead against that. And so to my colleagues, I'm just begging you, read the literature outside of what your hospital administrator, insurance company, or pharmaceutical company is telling you to read. Because when you delve into what I know in the laboratory and what my colleagues know and what my oncologists are seeing and what pediatricians like Dr. Thomas are seeing, you don't need a toxin in your body that is more harmful than the infection itself. I call COVID COLDVID now because we're really on to COVID-22. And Omicron is a cold for most people. But the more shots you get, the more toxic spike you get in your body, the more immune suppressed you will be. And that cumulative dose of a toxic protein will lead you at risk for neurologic disease, autoimmune disease, heart inflammation, clotting in your blood vessels, strokes, emboli, et cetera. It's time to stop this corrupt game.
Yeah, absolutely. And the increase in infections that you touched on, I mean, we're seeing way more herpes, shingles, Epstein-Barr virus, RSV. I mean, yes. It is the worst. I've been doing this for 35 years. This is absolutely the worst and earliest spike of RSV I've ever seen.
Very explainable too. You know, we've created a problem trying to solve another problem. So we keep creating problems. And what's the number three cause of death in America? Iatrogenic, doctor caused. I mean, that's the number three. I mean, between, you know, heart disease and cancer, we have doctor caused death. And
now we're going to fast forward to number one real quick here.
It's sure looking like that over time. Yeah. I hope not. I mean, I hope and pray for humanity. I hope the body can recover itself and can be amazingly resilient and people will wake up and take charge of their own health. Because I like on these shows to say, look, the best doctor you'll ever meet is here right now. And it's not me or Dr. Thomas. It's you.
It's you.
You are your own best doctor if you choose to take care of your health.
Absolutely. Before we end, I want to address something that just shocked me when I was at the same conference that you spoke at. These pictures of weird fibrous clots that look very different than a typical blood clot. I would think, first of all, well, secondly, pathologists are the ones who usually do autopsies, right?
Correct.
And my understanding was that there's sort of been almost a moratorium on autopsies, especially if it might be a death from COVID or the COVID vaccine. So therefore, if you don't look, you don't find. And now morticians are finding these clots. What's going on with that?
Okay, so Dr. Pretorius out of South Africa, she's done some brilliant work on these clots and the mechanism and how the spike protein alone. So you and I know, you know, when we have clotting cascades and our complement cascades and clotting cascades work together, this step, and your platelets make this little patch. You know, you scrape your knee, you've got this little patchwork of tiny microscopic bandage, your platelets. Even in the absence of platelets, that spike protein will cause proteins in the circulation to clump together. So some critics say, well, these clots are just forming after death. Well, the morticians never had trouble getting their embalming fluid into the arteries and veins before, or on rare occasions. So all of a sudden they're like, they get the back pressure when they're trying to pump in the embalming fluid. They're like, what the heck? Then they start pulling out these. And these are, I mean, they're like rubber bands. These are, look at that. That is horrendous. That is not normal. And so these consistently, or the consistency, as I look at it, you know, on microscope slides, you know, which I've done dozens of these. So, you know, we'll cut these and make sections, and then we'll look at them. There's an amyloid-like protein, which is not normal in the human body, that is accumulating. So this is, it's an abnormal protein. It has sugars bound to it as well. And then it causes the other normal blood elements, fibrin and, you know, trapped red blood cells and white blood cells are in these as well. But the amount of the abnormal clumped protein is what's concerning. And we know the S1 fragment of the spike protein, fantastic studies, again, colleagues around the world, don't believe me, go read the studies by Dr. Pretorius. She has shown the makeup of these and how they form and what's happening. And does everybody get them? Thankfully, no. Eventually, 5 years, 10 years from now, we're going to be able to go back and look at the genetics of who clotted, who got autoimmune, who got cancer, et cetera, et cetera. Genetically, we'll do a big look back. But if we can stop this now, let's stop this. But yeah, so again, panic everybody? No. Concern that you're putting a gene into your body that makes a protein that makes this happen in many people? Yeah, that is a concern. And it's science. I mean, I'm not making this up. And then some colleagues are like, oh, it only happens after death. No, I have more that interventional radiologists have pulled out of arteries, have pulled out of legs, have pulled out of the human body. So it's not just after death that these things are just congealing. And it's fascinating because my colleague, Dr. Burkhardt in Germany, he and I met in Vienna and we're going over some of the different tests to do and studies to find. He had this one patient, and every time she would get a little bit cold, extreme pain, kind of like Raynaud's in the fingers, multiply injected. So he drew her blood and literally could watch the little white strands start to form in her blood tube. Wow. And then spun it down and formed this big gelatinous mass, very similar to these. Hmm. Is it happening in everyone? No. Is it a concern? Yes. Is it one of the many mechanisms that the spike is causing harm? It is. Is it real? Absolutely it is. In lab medicine, are we able to identify the makeup of these things? So far, yeah, we've identified quite a bit of it, and we know mechanistically what's causing it. It's the spike protein from these injections. Stop getting these injections.
Wow. So I'm going to have you close out with your final recommendations for children, pregnant women, everybody. But before we get to that, did I miss something that you feel is really important for people to know?
You know me, Dr. Thomas, I could nerd out for hours. And I know I get nerdy. I try to break it down to a level that people can kind of understand. At the end of the day, I think, you know, we've gone over all these different harms. I try to remain optimistic. That's kind of who I am as a human. And with all these things we've described, is this something you want in your child? Do you want to put them at risk for this? Do you want to put that child at risk? And I mean, sadly, right here, this is slides from the heart of a young man that's not with us anymore. So is this. I have stacks and stacks of slides of organs and tissues from not just here, but around the world that have come to me so I can do these studies on them, of these young individuals that after shot one or shot two are no longer with us. This shot does not work for this virus. This shot is dangerous to your child. And remember, pregnant mom, you have a child within you. It may be this big, or this big, but all those things that we were discussing, that spike protein can get into the placenta and destroy the placenta and calcify the placenta and choke it off. That spike protein and some of those antibodies can sneak across that lipid nanoparticle. Remember, it can go everywhere. It can go into the placenta, into the umbilical cord, and into the baby. And now the baby can start making spike protein. This, the mRNA has shown up in breast milk in studies. That means that lipid nanoparticle can go anywhere, everywhere, and into anybody's secretion. The shot is not for any pregnant mom on the planet Earth, period.
Agreed.
Period. End of story. This is not for any child under the age of 195.
Agreed. So, kids of all ages, please take this information. Dr. Cole, thank you so much. Do your research, do your due diligence, but do not say yes to this jab until you've really dug deep. And the thing is, once you look, once you know, you can't unknow. And it becomes easy for, you know, you and I to say, oh, no way. We're not putting this in our bodies.
And we took an oath. We took an oath to the patient. I never took an oath to a three-letter government agency. I didn't take an oath to some bureaucrat. I didn't take an oath to a pharmaceutical company. I took an oath to the patient. My sacred duty, your sacred duty, is to first do no harm. And when we see these signals of harm, it behooves us and all of our colleagues, you know, many of them are waking up to the harms now. It behooves all of us to stand forward, protect that patient, and value life over anything else. And so, I mean, I'm just one guy, one voice in this battle with you, Dr. Thomas, and other people just trying to protect humanity. And at the end of the day, it's because we care. We have zero to gain from it. I've lost just about everything in terms of attacks and insurance contracts and business, et cetera. I know what you've gone through. If you want to understand the silence, listen to the silenced.
Yeah, absolutely. It you have to be willing to risk it all. And thank you, Dr. Cole. I know you are actually doing that right now by sharing. I know you're traveling the world, speaking the truth. And you've got that microscopic view and you've got those test tubes. I mean, the evidence is bam right here. And we need your voice. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Keep doing what you're doing, and I can't wait to rub elbows with you at another conference soon.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas, and thanks for all you do. And like I mentioned earlier, the invite is extended if you want to come spend a relaxing day on the farm. I know we're not too far from each other, so be great to see you in person. And yeah, thanks for all you do as well.
We'll definitely do it.
Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsandscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.